second part of waiting. Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. We'll open the House Committee on Revenue. This is the 28th day of February, and it is about 10 minutes after the hour of 1. Apologize for the late hour of starting. We've reviewed a couple of issues here with staff, and we're ready to go ahead and commence today. The first thing that let's do today is we'll go ahead and open a work session for the possibility of introduction of legislation. We will open that work session, and Paul, would you like to go ahead and we have a couple of pieces that are ready for introduction on behalf of the committee today.
Mr. Chair, you have two LCs in front of you, and as you're aware, the deadline was originally for today for introduction of bills, but that has been extended for a week. Mm-hmm. So we do have, if you look at your agenda, we do have several work sessions posted over the next couple of days for bills that come in for introduction. But today you have LC 2055, which is imposes a fee for issuance of First Oregon Certificate of Title. And the money is then divided among Department of Transportation, counties, and cities.
Colleagues, any questions relative to this? This is this was at the request of Association of Oregon Counties. I did have back in Section 6 on page 4, I did have one comment that I made to our revenue staff as well as to the counties. That is on line 23. I'd certainly like to have seen that that particular 33.34% move to the fund to repay the bonds which we authorized last session, so that there was a method of paying off the bonds, because those of you who have been here for a little bit of time know that we borrowed a considerable amount of money, and then that in last session we actually moved about $500 million forward in Department of Transportation that they hadn't been able to utilize in their road programs. And so I just felt like that maybe rather than pouring that money in a black hole, and I don't mean to really make it sound that bad, but that this might be a method whereby we could assist in trimming off a few years off those bonds. And those of us who have had house payments, that occasionally we'll make a principal payment a little earlier than is necessary, you know what that does to the far end of the obligation, how that will shorten that life of that up. And that was my observation in that regard. Any questions relative to this? You may or may not desire to vote yes on this today for allow it for committee introductions, but we're putting it forward to be introduced as a committee bill at the request of Association of Oregon Counties, AOC. Any objections to entering this bill as a committee bill, LC 2055? Hearing and seeing no objections, we will order LC 2055 to be introduced as a committee bill at the request of Association of Oregon Counties. Paul, LC 3267.
Okay. Just to follow up, Mr. Chair, on your schedule, on Thursday we do have an overview of the Highway Fund, and then on Friday we do have a meeting in which the Office of Economic Analysis is actually required to come before the Transportation and Revenue Committees and present the results of the Highway Cost Allocation Study. And they will be doing that on Friday, so you'll see that on your agenda. The next LC before you is 3267. And what this does is require a local government that imposes an income tax. It doesn't have anything to do with who allowance for imposing one, but if they do make that decision, as they can under current law, that the tax base that is used is the same that the state uses for income tax purposes. In other words, there's no difference in the tax base at the local level versus the state.
So as opposed to a wage-only income taxation, this would give us a uniform income tax for cities, counties, other municipal entities that would be imposing income taxes. The chair recognized Representative Riley.
Yeah, what would this do if with income earned outside the taxing unit?
Representative Riley, I don't think that would. You could still base it on the residence, as in the Multnomah County income tax case, the ITAX case. It would still be based on, it'd be resident based, but the taxable income within, that those residents pay to the local government would be used, would be the same as for the state.
So it would not be a tax imposed upon the people that worked in Multnomah County as much as it would be those that reside in Multnomah County, much like it would be a tax or uniform to the same way that the state says if you reside in the state of Oregon and have income in foreign states, then it would still be Oregon income, subject to any credits paid to the foreign.
Thank you.
Again, thank you very much. That was an excellent question, Representative Riley. Colleagues, we may or may not, again, this would, it's my understanding that a passage of a bill of this nature would basically make uniform any taxation proposed by cities, counties, or other municipal districts as opposed to an income tax based strictly upon wages earned in a taxable subdivision of the state. Other comments or questions? Are there any objections to the introduction of LC 3267 as a committee bill from the House Committee on Revenue? Hearing and seeing none, we'll order House Bill or LC 3267 introduced as a House bill at the request of the committee. Colleagues, I've handed to revenue staff, our legislative revenue officer, also a bill which we had printed up through our office in response to some ongoing concerns and discussions. We won't introduce it today, but it is in fact a beer tax, and it provides that counties throughout the state of Oregon could introduce their own beer taxes, and we will consider that as a legislative concept at a later time as well, for potential for legislative drafting as a committee bill. I realize that there's a tremendous amount of angst over these kinds of things. There are bills which will be assigned to the committee. We may or may not take up this bill. We may or may not take up any of those bills. But what this bill does, LC 2357, authorizes a constitutional change, returning back to the counties and local subdivisions the right to go ahead and impose a potentially uniform tax. Now, all 36 counties must approve of the tax and must approve of the rate. 35 of them approve and one disapproves. Then you got you do not have a uniform tax. So at any rate, it at least begins the discussion if we do bring forward a malt beverage tax. It brings forward the discussion of where this money could be raised and used for the implementation of a resource locally to address alcohol, drug, and other related abusive behaviors, potentially abusive behaviors, and the interdiction on behalf of those local agencies that we charge frequently, those political subdivisions that we charge frequently with delivering the services, and provides them their own resource for that delivery of service. We will, as I say, we'll bring that up at a later time. I just thought I'd bring that up while we were in work session as an item of discussion for potential future introduction of the committee bill. With that, we will close the work session on possible bill introduction, and we will now open a informational hearing. Paul, would it be your preference? I probably the entire reserve fund needs to just be done at one time as opposed to the public hearings on H.J. House Joint Resolution 2 and its implementation.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, the H.J.R. 2 is sponsored by Representative Lamb. I spoke with Representative Lamb, and his request was to go ahead and go through the background material first,
okay,
and then have him come before the committee and explain his proposal.
Okay, we will now open then a informational meeting and hearing on the reserve fund concepts. Colleagues, as we get ready to take a look at the reserve fund concepts, you do have handout material. And you'll please recall that this was an item which was discussed at some length during the interim, and actually some drafts, LC drafts, were proposed. The reason for bringing this forward to the committee today is that I think that it would be appropriate for us to have a very open and bipartisan attempt to discuss some of the issues that various folks were bringing up in the interim, and I think I'd like to do that as much as possible on a nonpartisan arrangement or a bipartisan arrangement, if we could, at least the discussion of spending limits and reserve funds as we go through this issue. So I hope to keep an open mind on the issue, and I would ask that each one of you please do also. So with that, Paul.
Okay, Mr. Chair, and this information that I'll go through with you is, a lot of it is the information that was developed during the interim by both the Joint Committee on Tax Reform and then later the Interim Revenue Committee, House Interim Revenue Committee. So I've got it divided into two sections. The first is looking at spending limit issues, and then the second section is looking at reserve fund issues. The bill before you for public hearing today is a reserve fund bill and not a spending limit bill, and I've got a summary of that, and you'll be able to fit it in with some of the other characteristics of a reserve fund. So the first issue is on spending caps, and if we look around the states that have some type of a formal spending cap, there are 19 of them that have one. 11 of those are constitutional. Actually, there are some states like Colorado that have both a constitutional and a statutory limit. But there are 11 constitutional and then 8 that are statutory only. And that includes Oregon. And I'll say a few things about our current spending limit that's in statute now. We actually did have a spending limit in statute beginning in 1979. That was modified by the 2001 legislature. The key issues for spending cap, there are really four things, and I think as you look at alternative proposals, at least for me, it's always helpful to set up this kind of a scorecard and say, what are the characteristics of these spending caps in terms of their target? What is it that they target spending to or limit spending to? What is the types of expenditures that are subject to limit? And I think what you'll find when you look at the nuts and bolts of spending limits is this is many times one of the most difficult areas. And you start excluding things, for example, general fund and so forth. Exceptions, when do you allow the legislature, or what kind of obstacles do you put preventing them from making exceptions to the spending limit? Obviously, if you've got exceptions are very easy to make, what's the point of having a spending limit? And finally, what do you do with excess revenue that when you have revenue more than you can legally spend according to the limit? These are the states that currently have limits. And you can see that if you look at my C's here mean constitutional, and the CPI is the consumer price index, and population. So these are so-called population limits, and you can see the states that tend to have them. The most famous is Colorado's Tabor limit, which is a CPI population-based limit. The Colorado system has gotten quite a bit of publicity, partially because of this limit, but also there's some other factors around that. For example, for any change in revenue-raising measures has to go before a vote of the people. Well, that's not, it's part of the Tabor Act, but it's not part of a spending limit. So it covers a whole series of things that can be done in Colorado and Colorado fiscal policy. It also applies to local governments as well. You can see, though, the variation. Here's Oregon with a statutory limit. And our limit now is a percent of personal income. So we define what spending is, and I'll talk about that in a minute, and then it's limited to 8% of personal income. And the personal income I'm talking about here is the numbers that the state economist was showing you Friday. This is the Department of Commerce series. They keep a series of all the states, what their personal income is of residents to make a non-resident adjustment. And it does not include capital gains, but includes all the other components of income. We think of wages, transfer payments, interest, earnings, dividends, so forth.
Do we have, Paul, what that actually looks like here? I guess we do in this next graph.
Okay. Yes, Mr. Chair. This is looking at how these targets have performed over time. So, you know, I think the first issue to look at in devising a spending limit is what are you going to target that limit to? And, of course, the one firm thing you can say, none of us knows what those lines are going to look like in the future, but we can look back historically and see how these targets have performed. And, of course, these are the three that we see in one form or another in all of the state spending limits that are in existence. Notice that personal income has grown faster than either population or CPI. And that's going to be the case as long as we have a growing economy. And over time, we have had a growing economy. So that's generally the case. And even when we go into recessions, such as we have here in the early 2000s, notice our drop here. These are all biennial numbers, so we're talking about 5% over a two-year period. So, but that's still, you know, some income growth during that time. Also notice that you go back to the 70s and you have income growth in the 30% range. But about 20% of that, or even more, was due to inflation. And you can see how the inflation rate shot up during this period as the CPI peaked at about 13% a year here in the late 70s and early 80s during the second surge in oil prices that occurred at that time. Also notice when you get a recession, typically you see this income growth drop below the inflation rate. That means your real income is declining. The other variable is population, which tends to grow more slowly. Also notice variations we had in the early 80s when we actually had net out-migration occurring in the state. We still had some positive population from the natural rate, but we had net out-migration during that time. But generally, we're going to grow about 2%, 1.5% to 2% a year has been our historical pattern. Now, the other comparison here is with personal income versus summing up population and CPI. And that's what you see for a number of the state targets. They add population and inflation together to get the so-called population measure. One measure you may see and may have seen is a constitutional proposed constitutional amendment by Don McIntyre that would limit state spending to population plus CPI. So similar to the Colorado limit and a number of other states have. Again, the pattern shows that you're going to get a tighter limit in terms of allowable state spending growth if you tie to population and CPI versus personal income. And that's going to always be the case, or nearly always the case, over time. The exception is when you go into recession. Here's in the early 80s. Notice that the yellow line, population plus CPI, is growing faster than the red line, personal income. What this means is that you have real per capita income is declining. So real per person income is dropping once you adjust for inflation. So that's you know, a definition of a recession. And you notice that occurred again here in the early 2000s, where this real per capita turns negative again, as we don't keep up with population and inflation in terms of income growth. I also put these lines, fixed lines, in here because you'll see when we talk about the proposal that the Interim House Revenue Committee worked on was a fixed percentage. And that fixed percentage became the proposal, so you can compare what those would look like. So if you go a 6% annual target, you've got 12% per biennium. So you can see, in general, we're above that during this inflationary period, but down below that 12% limit in the 90s when inflation got a lot lower. Here's another limit at 4% annual target, puts you about 8% for a biennium. And you'll see that indeed was the proposed target that came from the work of the Interim House Revenue Committee. Spending definitions, well, I think you're familiar with the different budgets that we have, and they are very, the size of the all funds budget is roughly three times the size of the general fund, as we have a series of dedicated funds, particularly the federal funds that are included. And you'll see that comes up as a big debate. This was particularly an issue in 2000 when Measure 8 was debated, which again was proposed by Don McIntyre, but Measure 8 included federal funds. There was some adjustment, but it was almost an all funds definition. You can see that the general fund has in general been more volatile, as you'd expect, because it's income tax based, and certainly in recent years it dropped much more sharply than all funds. Although it's interesting, you look in the early 80s, look at the all funds budget became negative because federal funds dropped so sharply in that time.
That was the end of revenue sharing, Paul.
Yeah. Revenue sharing was cut back sharply during the early 1980s. And as we know, that's a risk as you look out ahead in the next 10 years or so. I've also looked at general fund lottery and then all funds minus the federal funds as those are excluded. There's usually two different theories on federal funds. One is the theory that, you know, even if the federal government's going to pay the state to build pyramids and tear them down, if they're paying for it, it's still helpful for the state economy. And the other is you should look at federal funds as you do all other expenditures, and is this the highest priority and where we want those dollars to go. So there's kind of that debate that goes on over spending limits. Should we even include federal funds, be concerned about them, or just allow those to go without limits? The general fund, when you narrow that down to general fund only and go back to the 1970s versus personal income and inflation, notice that if we would have had a limit in place based on percent change in personal income, you can see that in general in the 90s, our general fund was above that personal income growth and also above the population with CPI. So you did exceed that during this period in the 1990s. And we would expect that in the general fund to be the case over time during periods of expansion because the income tax is greater than unitary elastic, meaning it's going to grow faster than income during periods of growth because it has a progressive rate structure. So we would expect this kind of line to be the same in the future. And of course, also, as we've observed, when the economy goes into recession, such as these two points here, it drops much further than does overall income and population. The current spending limit now that you have, the in 1979, the legislature enacted really a three-part fiscal program that included what was called the appropriation growth limit and also the kicker at that time and also a property tax relief program. The appropriation growth limit was repealed and replaced with a spending limit in 2001, and that limit is statutory and it's a fixed percent of income. One of the concerns of the sponsors of this proposal was that the appropriation growth limit, and indeed Colorado has experienced this as well, and a number of other states, had what's called a ratcheting effect. So that if you go into if you tie something to the percent change in income, if you go into a recession, you typically can't spend up to your limit because you don't have the revenue. Your revenues drop faster than the limit has, so you're down at a lower level. Once your revenue starts coming back in, you rebase at this lower level, your revenue starts coming back in, and then you're limited by the rate of growth coming out from that lower point. So that's called ratcheting, and that was a characteristic of the previous limit. And the concept here was to limit income as a percent of income. So it's set at 8%. If you spend 7.5% of personal income in one biennium, you could grow faster than income to get to the 8%. The other element to this proposal is it's prospective. It's based on forecast, whereas our previous limit was based on percent change in income the prior biennium. So that's another difference there. Do you base it on what the state economist is projecting income to be, or do you look at the prior 2 years? The area of subject spending is a tricky one because, again, it sounds straightforward, but there are a lot of areas that perhaps shouldn't be limited or you don't want to limit, and then you get into the definitions. And the definition we have now, the desire was to find something that was objective and outside determined. This is the General Accounting Standards Board language called appropriations for governmental activities. It includes business and fiduciary activities, things like public employee retirement system. And if you look at the all funds budget, that's a huge component of it. The interest earnings that come into that fund are almost as big as the general fund, about half the size of the general fund. So it's a large number. You exclude those because they're not related to current activities. It also excludes federal funds, donations, higher ed in particular, bond proceeds, and then tuition and remission programs. It does have language to allow the limit to be adjusted for ballot measures. And that's a big issue that comes up with limits. Should you make some exception for ballot measures? For example, when something like Measure 5 passes, should you allow the state to spend above the limit to backfill the property tax reduction? And then there's also, you can have an emergency with a 3/5 vote. The limit that we have in place now has not been, we've not exceeded it. It's only been in place since 2001, and of course we went into recession. So it has not, you've not been in a situation where you had to vote or make a decision where the limit was actually limiting what the budget was. The other issue is surplus revenue, and you'd see that in a number of proposals that will come before you, is what kind of provision do you have? If you got more revenue than you can spend according to the limit, what do you do with the revenue? Okay, I'll stop there, Mr. Chair, if there are any questions.
Questions relative to the potential spending limit issues, and I'm sure that we'll have a number of these issues to discuss, colleagues, particularly as we take a look at the two bills that we'll have for public hearing today.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Galizio is recognized.
Paul, I'm just curious, which elements of the Colorado plan do you think have been the most significant in creating what seems problematic for that state?
Well, the Colorado situation is quite complicated, and I have I think is a very good report was done by the Colorado Legislative Council. I'd be happy to make that available to anyone that would like to take a look at that. There are a series of elements to it. Certainly the biggest problem that they have had in the last couple of years, and the reason why the governor and the legislature have looked at ways to try to amend the limit, is the ratcheting effect. They went from, in 2000, they were second in the country in job growth, and they dropped to 49th by 2002. So, I mean, their economy dropped very sharply. They do have a significant income tax. They were hit very hard by the drop in income tax revenue. So they dropped well below their limit, because the revenue wasn't anywhere near what their limit was. So they made budget cuts. And now the Colorado economy, which is a high-growth economy over time, has begun to come back, and they can't restore those reductions. They have more revenue than they can spend in order to restore some of the cuts they made. So that's been a real inflexible component about getting their revenue in one biennium versus the next, and do they make cuts that they really don't necessarily want to make or don't think that the population wants to make.
In some respects, that's kind of in business, it's the same kind of an issue when you've got a lot of sales, but you don't have the collections on those accounts receivable. And so what happens is, if you're based upon a cash economy and you have really good sales but no collections, then you ratchet everything back. I mean, if you run a business like that, like Tabor does in Colorado, it's a recipe for breaking your business, because you can't come back and develop your budget based upon what you actually sold. You only base your budget upon what you actually collected from the sales. And so then as your economy returns, that is, you collect in the next cycle, then what happens is that you have to base it only based upon, and under the Tabor, it's just based upon what you actually expended the last time, and then only increment it up based upon the population and inflation, and there's no automatic, even if you could only grow, because based upon the prior example on the cash basis, you could only grow by 4% in a biennium in 2 years, even though Tabor would have provided, had you collected the cash that you had outstanding, that you could have grown by 8%, what happens is it ratchets the whole thing back so that the next time you're going to grow a maximum of 8% on the one that only grew 4%. And this was an element for pretty hearty discussion in the interim discussions that we had in revenue as to whether or not you'd ratchet that back. And I think we all came to the agreement in the interim that we wanted to look at, and the research bulletin that Paul had about the Tabor and its latent defects in Colorado and how it had affected Colorado, we'd want to go ahead and we'd want to make sure that we didn't have that ratcheting effect in anything we did in Oregon, so that you could continue to provide the services irregardless of the fact that you had a momentary blip that you would never catch up for.
One thing I might add too, Representative Galizio, on this complicated life for Colorado as well, is an additional amendment that has sets a different target for schools. So, and that has tended to be above. So that has had the effect of reducing the flexibility the legislature has had in trying to deal with their budget problems. So they have to maintain a guaranteed growth rate for schools at the same time they have large cuts in there.
Now, one of those is called the Gallagher Amendment, and the other was Amendment 25 or something.
I think it was Amendment 23, Mr.
23. And so Amendment 23 was the schools, and then...
That were the schools' guaranteed increase. There are some exceptions to that, but it's complicated their management of their shortfalls.
Okay. Follow up?
No, thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Well, the other side of the volatility is the periods of revenue decline. And that's, of course, the concept of a rainy day fund, which was something that really was a major national phenomenon in the 1990s. Many states enacted funds during that period, and it got to the point where we have 47 states that have a rainy day fund of one type or another. These vary greatly, though. There are some states that have rainy day funds with nothing in them. So they've been created, but they have a zero balance in effect. So there's quite a wide divergence in just how large these funds are and what kind of revenue sources they have. But they have formally been created in 47 states. As you recall, Oregon does not have a formal stability fund, does have the Oregon Education Stability Fund, which meets all the criteria of a rainy day fund. It was first proposed by the legislature to the voters in June of 2002, was rejected, re-proposed, and passed in September of 2002 as Measure 19. So that's our current Education Stability Fund, and I'll talk some more about that. Just as we have kind of a score sheet for the spending limit, I would suggest another score sheet for our rainy day fund issues. I think a rainy day fund proposal tends to have all four of these ingredients to it. And if you look at different proposals, it's one way of kind of keeping them separate in terms of how they address each of these issues. They have to have some kind of a revenue source if it's to be viable, at least in my opinion, to be viable over time. It has to have a revenue source to be triggers to access the fund. One of the criticisms you often hear with rainy day funds, does it become just a slush fund, for example, just when there's dollars needed for various types of programs? Doesn't there need to be ways to limit access? And, of course, if it's to be a stability fund, that's one of the ingredients it has to have. So there needs to be triggers that allow you to get to the fund when it's needed but not abuse it. And that becomes, of course, an art more than a science. The fund size, generally all of them have a certain size so that when they exceed that, the dollars go elsewhere. And the uses of funds can be limited or they can be simply general purpose.
Paul, would you, on that slide, would you comment relative to Measure 19 and our Education Stabilization Fund as to the four triggers under the Rainy Day Fund here?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have a slide on that.
Oh, you do? I beg your pardon.
Yes, so I have a slide on that, so you can put those in the categories. And what I would propose to do is when you get different bills to basically show them and that by these categories so you'll be able to make that comparison. And I've also done that with HGR, too.
Okay, excellent. Thank you, Paul. Apologize.
I think it's useful to step back. I think we've looked at this slide back at the beginning of the session, but just to remind yourself how often recessions have occurred in Oregon's history, post-war history. Of course, there's always the risk that the past might not tell us much about the future, but you can see in the immediate post-war period of about 20 years, you tended to see recessions, business cycles running about 5 to 7 years during that period. We did have a recession in 69-70, and I was in the Puget Sound area, and that was when you were supposed to turn the lights out, the last person to leave Seattle. But it didn't have a big effect in the Oregon area. We did not have an actual decline in employment, so it was not an annual job loss number. 73-75 was a recession year from the first oil embargo, yet little employment loss there. The biggest one was in the early 80s. Small loss in 1990-91. Both of these were characterized by strong in-migration, which offset some of these the effects of the national recession. And then finally, the one we just went through, which was 3 years of employment declines, the job losses of about 3.5% over that period. So as you look to the next, when will this next red bar occur, it's probably safe to assume, and hope it doesn't happen, but assume probably within a 5 to 7 year period, you'll see a declining period, and it could be sooner, of course, if we some of the risks that you talked about on Friday occur. And then to remember, in terms of looking at our state and how it reacts to national recessions, the dominant factor is this big green bar, which is the percent of value added in Oregon that comes from our manufacturing base. And you've seen that pretty consistently. That's the most volatile component. That's what made our economy grow in the 90s. But it's also at risk during recessions. This is what the kinds of purchases that can be postponed, particularly business capital spending, which is a big chunk of this green bar. The consequences of being a goods producing state, number one, in terms of reserve fund, statement of problem really, is that it's cyclically sensitive, meaning that when we go into recession, nation goes into recession, you can pretty much bet that Oregon's going to feel it pretty significantly. We also talked about the relative revenue sources and the point that the income tax will tend to be more volatile, particularly in this last cycle. Our income tax decline in the first year of the recession was about 12%, and 2 years of decline in a row before we started to finally see it come back, again, as the forecasters reported to you on Friday, that this number is starting to come back a little bit. And also, this slide you've seen before on general fund revenue history give you a sense of that volatility over time. This is very much reflective of a growing economy. I mean, we've basically had revenue growth. We have revenue growth in every biennium except three over this 70-year period. So it's most always going to be the case. The tricky issue for you to decide as policymakers is, you know, how frequent is this kind of occurrence going to be? Is this a one-off, unusual event that won't happen again, or is it going to be more indicative of the future? So, of course, if it is, then the arguments for reserve fund become much stronger. This is getting at the issue that Chair raised on the Education Stability Fund and what are the components of the Education Stability Fund that was created. And we actually have several proposals in the Senate and Senate Revenue Committee that will modify this, change the cap, and redirect more earnings. So you might well see some of those kind of proposals as well as outright reserve fund proposals. The Stability Fund is constitutional. That's more probably due to the fact that the legislature had an endowment fund, education endowment fund, that was in the Constitution that was converted into the Stability Fund. But, of course, the limitation that does is, for example, we have a Senate proposal that would propose raising this fund size due to pretty much the consensus that recessions are more severe than we thought they could be after the last one we've gone through. But this requires a constitutional or a resolution to the people, the general election, to change that percent. So once you have something in the Constitution, of course, it means you've got to go to the ballot to make any kind of changes. The revenue source is 18% of lottery earnings. I think we've talked a little bit with you about kind of our changing view of lottery as a long-term revenue source. Frankly, we thought when this was first proposed and voted on by the people that lottery earnings growth would be less than general fund growth over time, because our assumption was that video poker would grow maybe 3-4% a year, whereas we think the income tax would probably grow about 6% a year over time. So what that means is that your earnings flowing into this fund would not keep pace with your need for protection as a share of the budget. However, with the proposals coming forth from the governor and looking at what's the long-term growth here, that can be more of a debatable issue right now. Certainly with, if indeed we realize the revenue expectations of the line games and whatever other adjustments the lottery makes, the Stability Fund will pick up 18% of that. So it does give it a more of a boost in the short run anyway. The key issue is over the long run, will this be an adequate revenue source to do the things you want it to do? The triggers for the fund. When we look at triggers, I break them into three categories. One is political, which usually means vote requirements. And you have a political trigger that has to be met each time you access the fund. It's 3/5 vote, no matter what. So that 3/5 vote is a constant. The other elements to it are an economic trigger, which is declining employment for 2 quarters or more, or 3 out of 4 quarters. That's really designed to mimic a recession. At the national level, we talk about 2 declining quarters of overall activity measured by gross state product. We don't have a comparable measure for the state. So we're kind of stuck with the employment measure. That's the best data, the quickest data we get. Or what I call a budgetary trigger, which is a 2% decline in the general fund revenue forecast. And those of you that were here last session recall that just prior to July 1, the end of last biennium, the legislature, it was a House bill, and it came out of House Revenue Committee, made a finding that we're meeting this criteria of 2% or more below the close of session forecast, and therefore directed the DAS to deposit the incoming Stability Fund revenue to transfer those dollars to the Treasury for a distribution to the state school fund on May 1st of this year. So, and actually the way the bill read was to transfer 90% of the revenue that went into the Stability Fund up until May 1st. So that's what happened.
Christian Berger?
Paul, a couple of points. The 3/5 vote, this political, is of this body, is it not?
Yes, that's correct.
And
Representative Berger, 3/5 of each chamber.
Yes. And when was this enacted? What session?
This was enacted, was converted to the Stability Fund by the third special session, referred it to the voters, and it was approved as Measure 19 in September of 2002.
September 2002. Mm-hmm. So, my point being that we don't have a long history with this particular structure.
That's true. In fact, one of the things that I was looking at is the rankings through Governing Magazine of the fiscal affairs of the state, and they rank us low, and one of the criticisms is that the fund has not been used, but of course the issue was the fund wasn't created until there was a fiscal crisis.
President Passy, recognized.
Thank you. Well, on that note, it's hard to go anywhere with a rainy day fund when you begin it in the worst bottom of the trough. And I was just wondering, Paul, what you thought. I mean, would you consider this an adequate rainy day fund when compared to what other states do? I mean, notwithstanding the time we began and had to rate it every 2 weeks.
President Hess, you know, I think it is important to note that you know, we can debate lottery earnings and their potential over time, but we have certainly found in the recession that they're very stable. So you do have a stable source of revenue going in that has a constitutional dedication. So compared to a lot of states, that is a strength rather than a fund that just gets appropriations based on if there's extra dollars around. So I think that's probably a plus. There has been considerable discussion about the 5% general fund budget. I went back and dug out some of the work that was done back in 98 and 99 on proposing a rainy day fund, and 5% was thought to be about the norm. We thought the typical recession would knock us off our growth trend by about 5 to 7%. So a 5% size seemed reasonable. That's kind of changed with the experience of the last recession, and you're seeing more and more states wanting to up that number, and that's, I think, why you're seeing proposals coming forth now. Again, it's back to this issue, was this last recession kind of a one-off change and just due to a perfect storm in terms of the capital markets and other factors, or is it more indicative of the kind of instability we're going to see in the future? Right now, I tend to think there's some good arguments that we may see more instability in our revenue stream in the future, and that this is something that should be looked at seriously, the percent size of that fund.
Mr. Chair.
Yes. Was that responsive, Representative Hass? Representative Riley?
Yeah, you're talking about changing the percent on this fund, but this is just a public education fund. Wouldn't it be reasonable to have another rainy day fund for other purposes?
Representative Riley, that's, you know, if you are developing a fund for general purposes and where you want to come into a special session and allocate dollars just as you would during the session when you're determining a budget and prioritizing things and you know, allocating resources that way, yes, it makes sense to do that. The counter argument is that you get, you know, almost 60% of your general fund budget is now education related. And keep in mind that this is public education, so even though it's been used to be deposited in the state school fund, it could be used for higher ed and community colleges as well. So it is a big chunk of the budget, yet it makes sense to give the flexibility to deal with the problems. You'd want to have that more broadly defined.
Thank you. Representative Boquist is recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, you're discussing the fund size as being 5% of the general fund budget in the prior biennium, yet the revenue source is only 18% of lottery earnings total. Can you give us where are these lines going to cross? If you're guessing, if it's 5% now, when would we ever fill up that 5%? We're talking about moving a number that, are we ever going to reach the 5% to start with?
Representative Boquist, that's, you know, when I was talking about kind of the long-term assumptions, that's exactly what we discovered, was we were asked, what happens if we raise that to 10%? Well, if you assume that lottery is going to grow less than general fund, you never catch up. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you're trying to get a certain percentage of the prior biennium, so you never do get there. So the issue of fund size then becomes related back here to revenue source. One of the other things that is an important difference in the stability fund, and this has to do with where it came from, it was an education endowment fund in which the interest earnings off that endowment fund were statutorily allocated. Three-fourths of them went to pay lottery bonds for schools in the past, and another fourth went to needs grants. That allocation remains in statute. So the fund doesn't retain its own earnings. And that's another factor that influences the growth of the fund over time. Of course, a fund that retains its own earnings and reinvests them will grow faster. So, but your point is exactly right, that you, unless your revenue source is going to grow faster than your general fund over time, you won't catch up.
I think we did have a discussion of the fact that in 8 or 9 years it could amount to 700 to 900 million, depending upon some of these other kinds of things. But that anticipated that general fund would grow so that you could use the 5% and have it be a certain amount. It had a lot of factors. I think at the time there was a pretty healthy discussion about it back in 2002. Mm-hmm. Please continue, Paul.
The other thing, of course, in terms of the timing, we looked at those recessions, but we also, just prior to the last recession, we had the longest expansion in U.S. history. So it's always hard to tell what's a normal pattern mm-hmm. now. If you need this fund every 5 to 7 years, it clearly wouldn't fill up under this revenue structure.
Paul, wasn't there another trigger? I thought I recalled another trigger with an economic crisis, the governor declaring an economic crisis.
Yes, that's correct, Mr. Chair, the emergency declaration. These three-fifths vote and declining revenue and or a decline in general fund, these two are both ors, so either one of these would trigger. Either the budgetary or the economic would trigger, but the three-fifths vote is an and. You have to have the three-fifths. And in fact, you don't even have to have the budgetary or the economic if the governor declares an emergency. The governor could, for whatever reason, declare an emergency, but you still have to have the three-fifths.
Three-fifths would still
three-fifths be. Is a constant.
And it was my recollection that if the legislature were want to tamper with this kind of thing, and the governor would pander to the legislature, was willing to do that, that you could come up with a program where each year the governor would declare an emergency, and each year three-fifths of the legislature would come forward and say it's time for us to clean this fund out. And of course, the issue there was that, you know, you got to have a lot of skullduggery going on at the same time.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, that's the two sides of these stability funds is you want to create access so that you can get to it when it's needed and with fiscal problems. On the other hand, if access is too easy, the fund will never fill up and won't serve its purpose.
Who'd have thought it, huh? Okay, I'm sorry. Please proceed.
Okay, the next slide I have is the bill before you today for public hearing. And the HJR 2 and the implementing language is in House Bill 2345. That measure is constitutional. I think Representative Lim is here to talk about that. So I'll go through this for a couple of minutes and then finish and turn it over to Representative Lim. But it's a constitutional provision because it does alter the kicker calculation, which now, of course, requires a vote of the people, a constitutional change. What the bill does is use those surplus kicker refund and credit is the corporate piece of that, and redirects those dollars into reserve fund, so that becomes the revenue source. The trigger is a little different than the Education Stability Fund, which has an employment growth trigger. This has only an economic trigger, and it's an unemployment rate above 7% for two consecutive quarters. The fund size is set at $1 billion, so that the fund would have to fill up to $1 billion, and then you'd return to the surplus kicker refund credit revenue system we have now. The fund uses would be, as Representative Riley was talking about, would be for general purposes rather than a specific purpose. So this would be the proposal that's contained in HJR 2. I'll finish with a discussion of kind of where the interim House Revenue Committee left the discussion of a spending limit reserve fund proposal back last June. And again, going through the elements, the committee looked at a constitutional actually was a constitutional revision because it more than amendment, it changes two elements of the Constitution. It had an 8.1% biennial growth. This is on a fixed base. So the way it was set up, you determine what the fixed amount was in dollar terms. It's about $12 billion. And then it grows 8.1% per biennium for the target on in perpetuity. So this does not have the ratcheting effect that we talked about in the case of the appropriation growth limit or the Colorado limit now. So what that means is that if revenue grew, for example, revenue grew 0% one biennium, you wouldn't be able to increase spending. For the next biennium, you'd be able to, you'd have room under the cap to grow above 8% because there would just be a line out there that would determine your limit. There's quite a bit of discussion over subject spending, as there usually is. General fund lottery, there was an exclusion of county transfers and the education stability fund dedications, although used when the fund was used, when the education stability fund was withdrawn from, it would count against the spending limit. And plus any revenue that was from a new general tax. If a new general tax was voted on, then those dollars had to be spent within the limit. One of the things that we spend a lot of time, us bureaucrats that try to figure these things out, is how do you do what's called fund shifts? When you, if you have a general fund limit, what's to prevent a future legislature from coming in and say, gee, I want this new program, but it's over the spending limit, so I'm not going to call it general fund, I'm going to call it other fund. So there was a series of fund transfer language in there where you'd have to make, LFO would have to make a calculation on those transfers. There was a lot of debate over the exceptions, and the exceptions were a three-fifths vote was the requirement, and there were two ways that was set up. One was for a one-time change, and the other was for a permanent change in the base. So if you have this base, you're growing at 8.1%. You could just raise that base, and then it would keep growing 8% from that point. And a lot of discussion around the effect of initiatives in particular because of our history over the last 15 years and how that's affected the general fund and how it's allocated. Surplus revenue above the limit, this is where you really have a change in the debate, the discussion, the issue that the chair just raised about how do you limit withdrawing money out of the reserve fund and make it so it's reasonably done. Well, the spending limit kind of changes that debate because essentially what it says is you can spend up to the cap and then nothing above it. So what that does is turn this into a majority vote question.
Is that German reaching? The cap and reaching?
What have I got? Oh, region. Yeah.
Region. It'd be German, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
The cap and region.
Da, Mr. Chair. Da, yeah. Herr Chair. So the reserve fund side of that is, again, constitutional on the revenue, as in the case of HJR 2, does come from the surplus kicker revenue, and that would be above the spending cap. The lottery would be included in this calculation. The revision repeals the kicker statute, so that the dollars above that go into the reserve fund. The triggers, again, are a majority vote up to the limit, so there is no finding required in terms of accessing the fund. It just, you can't spend above the limit, spending limit. So it works in conjunction with the spending limit. The cap is for 15%. We had talked about 5%. We've seen proposals of 10 and 1 billion in HGR 2, but this is a 15% cap. Once you get the fund 16% or more, then you return the amount back to 15% as a kicker. There is a new calculation here where you look at the amount of general fund revenue comes from corporate versus personal, and then that determines the allocation among personal and corporate income taxpayers. So that's where the committee left things last June.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Hass.
Thank you. One quick question. We have a spending cap, and obviously we'll be talking about whether we need a new one, but there's no spending cap on tax expenditures. I was just wondering what your knowledge is of other states, how they deal with this, whether we could actually do it, because it seems to me that that is as much of an open window to tax dollars as actual budget issues.
Representative Hass, there is certainly a growing use of tax expenditures. Tax expenditure reports have become a lot more common in recent years. I've had several phone calls on those over the last couple of years. I don't know if it fits in terms of the usually the arguments in terms of the spending limit. I think the argument regarding the spending limit is to the assumption that the public sector will grow beyond its optimal size if you don't put a limit. And the argument would be that a tax expenditure is not necessarily an increase in the size of the public sector, although it may have the same budgetary effect in the short run. So that if you what you're doing is you can limit the size of the public sector through limiting its revenue. So most of the discussion, I think, around the spending limit is around the theory that the public sector will not limit itself to its appropriate size. It will grow too big.
Who has the key to that? The information has graphed out the expenditures, tax expenditures in the past, Paul, in addition to just the booklet.
Mr. Chair, the tax expenditure report originated actually with the House Revenue Committee going back to 1995, and it was established at that time, I was not here, but the Legislative Revenue Office developed a mock report based on what we knew in terms of tax law and made estimates around what revenue would be if you would expand the base and make it consistent with, you know, without the credits or deductions. That was turned over to Department of Revenue with the legislation, and then they've issued the report ever since. We review the report with them each time before it comes out and discuss their estimates. A lot of their estimates come from our original impact estimates, but then we'll talk about, were we wrong on that one? Did we guess too high or too low? Sometimes we can go back and look directly on the returns. We know how much was used in terms of credits, for example. So we can just do a run off the Revenue Department's computers to get those numbers. Other times it's much more judgment involved.
Representative Hass?
Well, thank you. I just as helpful as that tax report is, it still isn't the analytical or auditing function of some of those expenditures, which I think, as you noted before, I mean, they go through far less scrutiny than a budget bill down at the other end of the building. And it's just always floored me that these hairdressers' budgets take, you know, 2 weeks to do, and we just, you know, let go through a $20 million tax expenditure without even really questioning it.
Mm-hmm. Representative Hass, you know, I was this weekend. I was working on our Legislative Revenue Office's little budget for Ways and Means, and I was going back through the statutes of our duties, my duties, and one of them is the tax expenditure report. I mean, that's listed as one of them to do that analysis, and so we're committed to doing whatever analysis you would like to see us do. The discussion we've had before is over that evaluation phase, and that I think is a difficult thing to do. The estimate part, I think we can get some pretty decent estimates, but an evaluation, I think, takes some real care and effort, and that's something I don't think we've done consistently, as you say.
Yes, Representative Bradley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Paul, just following up a little on Representative Hass's previous question, wouldn't a spending limit make it more desirable on a legislator's part to create more credits, tax credits? You see where I'm going with that?
Yes, Representative Riley, I think that's true. You know, it's if you look at these at the idea of these of spending limits, They're based on the notion that there are built-in forces within the way the public sector operates that encourages the public sector to grow beyond what, you know, what economists who call public choice theory would suggest is what people really want. So that's the argument behind them. You know, if the legislature were to react to what the voters wanted to see and those forces weren't at work, then it wouldn't be needed. So I think you have to start from that premise that there are forces within the public sector. There's a lot of literature on this. Forces within the public sector that would push it beyond its optimal growth. So therefore, you need this constraint to keep that from happening. And that's the argument. But yes, it would have that effect that if as you approach the limit and you want to get something done in terms of a particular program, tax expenditures would be an alternative way to do that that wouldn't violate the limit.
And you can keep your constituents happier, right?
Representative DeLisi.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned before there's a desire for, you know, the optimal size of growth in the public sector. So are you aware of any consensus among economists on what would constitute the optimal growth of the public sector?
Representative Blasio, economists punt that question. It's, it's a political question. There is no optimal size. The optimal size is what the people want. I mean, it's their preference functions, what they see is the most desirable size of government. You look around the world, you see vastly different sizes of government. And I'm not talking about, you know, income-related differences, but differences in percentage of resources that people are willing to turn over to the public sector. The European countries, of course, have larger public sectors, and presumably that reflects a different desire for size of government in those countries than you see in the U.S. and some other countries.
Good point, Paul.
All right. I recognize
right in the gold mine.
Representative Boquist. No question. Okay.
Thank you very much, Paul. We're going to go ahead and let's close the informational portion of our hearing today, informational meeting. We'll open a public hearing on House Joint Resolution 2 and House Bills 2345. Colleagues, you've heard Legislative Revenue Officer Paul Warner give us a brief introduction to both House Joint Resolution 2 and the House Bill 2345 is the enabling legislation provisions to conform to the Constitution and implementing House Joint Resolution 2. We call Senator Lim. If you'd like to come forward, Senator Lim. Thank you very much, Senator Lim. Senator. Representative Lim. As I can still call you that occasionally. Apologize. I told this story about him before. I'll tell it again. Somebody said, shouldn't I call you by the highest title that you've ever received? And he said, well, if you did that, wouldn't you just call me Dad?
Okay. And Chair Butler and members of the committee, I believe the representative is more higher than the senator. You can call me representative. For the record, my name is John Lim. Former state senator and a current House representative from the District 50 in Gresham area. It is my great pleasure and privilege to speaking to you today concerning the HJR 2. Already that the my good friend Paul Warner already explained what the HJR 2 does. But I'm not going to go into the detail of this HJR 2. But during my campaign last year, I heard from my constituents and from the leaders of my community that we need to have a reserve fund in the state government. Not only it was the wish from my constituents, but also it is my wish. I'm sure it is your wish too. We should be prudent how we spend our tax dollars instead of spending all what we have, and when the recession hits, that we don't have enough money. And it seems to me, I'm not an economist, but I'm speaking from my common sense, that the usually 10, 15 years we have a prosperity of economic upturn, and then after 10, 15 years it's always the time comes of economic recession. In the past, we have not prepared for the downturn, and I think it is about time. It has been dragging on too long, and we should have enough political willpower at this time to make some reserve for the future downturn which will be coming. Economy is cyclical. It is not always going up and up and up. When it's going up, it's going to come down. And that's the fact. And I don't want to bring the Bible story that in Egypt there has been 7 years of prosperity and 7 years of famine. And fortunately, we have 10 years prosperity and usually 2 to 4 years economic depression. And so HJR 2 will do that. According to this HJR 2, my intention was not to take away the private individual kickers. I meant to be only corporation kickers. As if my remembrance is correct, since 1979, 7%, 7 times kickback corporation kicker, and 6 times kickback to the individual kickers. As I gathered the total amount, it has been approximately $2 billion we kicked to the corporation and to the individual kickers.
What was the dollar amount again, Representative Lim?
About $2 billion, total amount of kick in the past since 1979.
That was all kickers.
All kickers, right. Yes. I think we have been kicking around too much on this kicker issue. Instead of kicking out 7, 6 times, we should kick in. Am I kicking around too much? Anyway, I talked to the Paul Warner about the 10:50 today in the morning, and then what I was going to say. What did I discuss, Paul? It will be about the, if it kicks this year, corporation kicker will be about $60 million, you mentioned. I think it's prudent. It is not taking away the kicker completely away. As long as it reaches up to $1 billion, which is might not be 10% of the general fund, but $1 billion is a lot of money. It might take 10, 20 years to get there, but still we have some money available when the time comes. And additional funding from the general fund should be able to go in there. Some that the lottery fund might be able to get in there. So instead of a kicker alone, with many other that the monies going in there might be able to reach $1 billion faster. Are we willing to increase more taxes? Chances are we are not. People give us a resounding voice, no more taxes at this time yet. Already we tried Measure 30, it didn't pass, including Multnomah County. Are we continue to rely on the lottery in the future? Lottery is that has been a somehow stable funding, but it is unstable funding in the future. I think it's good to hear that we are going to have another $200 million, and according to the March projection, maybe $100 million from the additional tax and $100 million from the money left over from this biennium. So it's good news. We are having another $200 million. Are we going to spend it all? Or are you going to reserve some money for the future? I'm not talking about this money for education alone. This could be used for education, but I'm talking about a general fund for the when the unemployment hit more than 7%, we could use this money to stimulate the economy. And when the economy goes well, then we will have more money to spend for the education. I think it is unforgivable at this time if you don't reserve any money at all. I believe that the one way to do it, reasonably use kicker. I met many people. Don't kick the money to us. Keep the money and do something for the state, for education, for unemployment, the recession. And of course, some people believe kicker as a sacred cow. That's our money. We need to have it, and we are entitled to have it. So I'm not proposing to take the money away 100%. Only I'm talking about the corporation kicker until it reaches $1 billion, and then we can kick it back. So I hope that with my bill, HJR2, that they do something about for the future of our state, for the future expected unemployment rate. And it is unconscionable our state enjoys that the number one in the nation on unemployment high rate, 7.5%. Still high. It is coming down, but it is still too high for me and for the Oregonian to accept it. And that's what the SJR 42 and the House Bill 2345 is, that the bill implementing of this SJR 42. Let the people have a chance to vote on this issue. Let's send it to the people. Let's hear from the people. What they are going to decide is up to the people. I'm hoping with HJR 2 we shall have some future in the economic prosperity. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and the members of the committee.
Thank you, Representative Lim. Questions of Representative Lim? Representative, let me just ask a couple. We just have looked at some slides. Slide number 17 and slide number 10. Slide number 10 talked about the four devices that were the key issues relative to a rainy day fund, the revenue source, the triggers, the fund size, and then the use of the funds. The use of the funds, number four, on what we've just had as slide 17, indicated for general purposes. Representative Lim, can you share with us your vision of what the Education Stabilization Fund would look like in relationship to a reserve fund established under House Joint Resolution 2, and then how those two would dovetail together, recognizing that 18% of the net lottery proceeds are presently serving to increase the reserve balances in the Stabilization Fund.
Okay, I have not looked into deeply on the Education Stabilization Fund. That's strictly from the lottery fund that they will reserve the people, passed by the people. My HJR 2, that the triggers when 7%, more than 7% unemployment in our state, and when it reaches up to $1 billion, and the legislators can use up to $200 million a year or $400 million in biennium. And there's no specific mechanism for it. Only limit is maximum $400 million legislators can use for additional education or to reduce the unemployment or training for them or to stimulate the economy. This money is additional to the general fund, whatever that the legislators directed to use.
Okay. And so this money up to $400 million per biennium, assuming the fund was at full size, and did you say that the earnings on this fund stayed with the fund until it got to the
exactly.
Until the $1
billion? Yes.
And so those could be utilized for education purposes as well as other general fund purposes.
To stimulate the economy.
Okay. All right. Other questions? Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lim, did I understand you clearly that your proposal contained here only deals with the corporate kicker.
And that's right.
In place existing language and statute and constitution about personal kicker.
Yes, personal kickers stays. Somehow the bill is written to kick all individual and corporation kickers, that way as it is written. But that my original intention is to keep the corporation kicker,
okay.
And then that the amendment is coming in.
So let me get this right.
Yes.
What's written here doesn't say that, but that was your intention?
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I would be interested to see what the corporate kicker has done, Paul, in relation to this. You've got it. And it's in your bestseller, I know, and I'll look it up. Thank you.
You can share that with us, Paul.
Representative Berger, the corporate kicker has not kicked. Of course, as Representative Lynn mentions, there's $60 million forecasted now, but it has not kicked since the 95-97 biennium. And then there were two large ones in both 93-95, 95-97. It was $203 million and $167 million. So that's $370 million during that two biennium period.
Okay. And, of course, that would have been used under the under the triggers. That would have been used by the time you hit two quarters of 7%. Did we have that kind of...
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. Representative...
wouldn't it have to have reached its full size to have been used?
Well, that's the question.
It's got to be reached until $1 billion, until we
You're
can
right.
use it.
Yes.
You're right. It wouldn't,
yeah.
It would not have been used. Lines 9 and 10 on page 2. Monies may not be appropriated from the reserve fund unless the balance of the reserve fund exceeds $1 billion.
So it would still have sat there plus the, with approximately $400 million in earnings in it. Still would be left unused.
Mr. Chair, if I may interject just one more thing. If we could use individual kickers, it will that the faster to reach $1 billion. But chances are, if we do that, chances are it's not going to pass.
Right.
And so I'm being more practical that if we kick the corporation kicker into the reserve fund, chances are that we shall be able to pass the constitutional change.
Representative Lim, obviously you have the benefit of the 2020 hindsight and recognizing that the fund had this been available during all of the 80s and all of the 90s, that we'd still not have been able to use this in 2002.
No.
That make any difference to you?
That will make so. Another suggestion that any other funds that we have in a general fund, we are talking about the maximum 10% of a general fund for reserve sometime in the future. And if we reserve from the general fund into this account, we shall be able to reach more faster.
So the
instead of kick our loan.
Legislature could optionally elect to make contributions in towards the $1 billion.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yes.
I suppose if the fund was at $980 million after interest was credited to it, and you were in a serious downturn in the economy, the legislature could elect to go ahead and put another $20 million in it.
Exactly.
Make it kick at $200 million per year.
It's up to the legislators. As long as it's up to a $1 billion.
We'll figure out a way to get to it one way or the other, wouldn't we? Yes, Representative Riley.
And The last thing you talked about, the option of putting more funds into it, would that not look to people as if we were using the kicker?
Well, kicker amount is limited, and it will take a long time to get there, maybe 20, 30 years, even more. And so when the time, chances are we are going to have another recession before 20 years. So if the legislators have the wills to put some more money in it from the general fund instead of spending all the money, even this year we are expecting a couple hundred million dollars according to the projection at this time. If you could put even $100 million into this reserve fund, that will be a real good thing.
Representative Boquist, recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two questions, Representative Lim. You did indicate that there's an amendment in process to get it back to the corporate. Is that not correct?
That's correct, yes.
And follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
And the second question, while not ideal, what would you think if the triggering mechanism, instead of being $1 billion, was, say, $500 million? Because you forecasted $400 million is all you could spend in a biennium. So if you were over the $500 million mark going into a biennium, would another compromise not be reasonable to, say, lower that threshold? Keep the $1 billion top, but have a $500 million bottom? Your thoughts?
Chair Butler and then Representative Boquist, I think that's a real good question. I'm flexible, even $500 million or $1.5 billion. When we're talking about the reserve, we are talking about at least 10% of the general fund, or sometimes 15% of the general fund. If we lower such like a $500 million, it could be work, but it will wipe out that the $400 million right away the next 2 years when the recession hits. So I think it's prudent, at least we have a double amount of money, which means at least $1 billion, that the recession might hit just 2 years, but it could be 4 years. Then we have some money available in there. I think that's a more prudent way to approach this, in my view.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you. Other questions for Representative Lim? Thank you very much, John. And we understand that 2345 is the implementation language of this.
Yes.
Good. With that, thank you very much,
very much,
Representative. And we will go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2345 and House Joint Resolution 2. Colleagues, that finishes the business which we have for today. I'm going to go ahead and ask the vice chairs if they will stay for just a few minutes longer to visit with myself and Dr. Warner. And with that, we will go ahead and close General Government, close House Committee on Revenue for today.